As you drive along the road, it's very likely that you will see one or more animals lying on the road that have been struck by cars. Welcome to Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. I'm Salwa Khan. Millions of animals all over the world are killed each year when they collide with a vehicle on a road. Perhaps you've been in a situation where you have struck an animal. Most of us regret these collisions, yet they keep happening. Are there ways of minimizing the impact of cars and roads on defenseless animals? Road ecologists think so. Road ecologists and their field, called road ecology, have been studying the impact of roads on both humans and wildlife. My guest, Ben Goldfarb, has written a book called Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet, in which he charts a history of roads, the vehicles that traverse them, and the many important effects that has on us all. Ben is an environmental journalist and author. I asked him why he decided to write his book, Crossings.
You know, really, this book began in 2013. In a lot of ways, more than a decade ago, I was in Montana writing about wildlife conservation and habitat connectivity. You know, this idea that animals need large landscapes to move through in order to migrate and find each other and mate and access food and all the things that, you know, all organisms need. And, you know, one of the barriers to that movement of wildlife was Highway 93, this highway that runs sort of north to south through Montana and across the country. And while I was sort of researching Highway 93, I had the chance to go up on this wildlife overpass that had been built over the highway to allow animals like grizzly bears and moose and elk and bobcats to safely navigate this highway that was, you know, bisecting their habitat. And it was just such a kind of a beautiful experience in a lot of ways, you know, standing up on this wildlife overpass at sunset, you know, thinking about all the creatures that were going to use it that night. We do so much on this planet to make lives, to make animals' lives harder and more dangerous. And here was this, you know, beautiful bridge that we'd built to make their lives easier and safer. I just found that incredibly inspiring and interesting. And that was really what got me started on the journey that led to this book.
You have a lot of fascinating information in the book, and I'm hoping we can cover some of it. But one of it, obviously, you've done a lot of research. So let's start with a short history of roads.
Sure. So, you know, roads really begin in a lot of ways as animal trails. And that's one of the ironies of roads, I think, is that, you know, there are these structures that kill animals today, and yet they began, you know, in some cases millennia ago as trails that, you know, especially bison, kind of carved through the landscape. And then those, you know, those animal trails became Native American footpaths and then became wagon roads and then gravel roads. And eventually some of them became our, you know, our biggest interstate highways. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the history of roads is this sort of layered history of, you know, human and wild users all moving together across the landscape, you know, creating these travel routes that, you know, we still use today.
How many miles of roads are there in the world and in the U.S.?
It's a good question. So in the U.S., we have about 4 million miles of road. Worldwide, there are something like 40 million miles. And of course, there are new roads being built all of the time. You know, we're due for another 15 million miles or so of just paved roads, to say nothing of unpaved roads, by the middle of this century. So we're entering this period that ecologists have called an infrastructure tsunami, this wave of new construction, you know, that's headed for countries like Nepal and Kenya and Myanmar, you know, countries that, unlike the U.S., haven't built up their infrastructure all that dramatically yet, but, you know, are in the process of doing that now.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here today with Ben Goldfarb. He's an author and environmental journalist, and his book is Crossings: How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And there have been a lot of movies, books, articles written about cars and the roads they drive on, which emphasize the sense of freedom and adventure and fun. Do you think that's affected how we think about cars and driving?
I do think so. Yeah. You know, I think we have this mystique of the romance of the open road, right? That's something that, you know, that all so many, as you said, Saul, well, you know, so many great writers and artists and musicians have reinforced, you know, from Jack Kerouac to Bruce Springsteen, you know, this idea that highways are freedom and mobility, you know, they're how we get everywhere. And, you know, certainly we all use roads for all kinds of useful reasons, right? They're how we get to schools and hospitals and grocery stores and trailheads, you know, there I find myself driving all the time, like, you know, most people do. And, you know, and so certainly, you know, roads are both these useful structures, and they're also these cultural artifacts that have a lot of weight. And, you know, to me, I think that one of the paradoxes of roads, one of the many paradoxes of roads that I try to explore in this book, is that, you know, as you say, we have this idea that highways connote freedom and mobility and movement. And yet for wild animals, they're doing exactly the opposite, right? They're preventing animals from moving around the landscape and being free and, you know, and finding all of the resources they need. So roads are simultaneously facilitating human mobility and truncating wild animal mobility. And that's, you know, one of the tensions that I try to explore in this book.
In what ways have roads changed the environment?
Yeah, it's almost hard to say how they haven't changed the environment. All of the different connections and relationships between roads and nature are so vast. I mean, you know, for starters, roads are this huge source of animal mortality, right? We hit wild animals all of the time, and unfortunately, you know, we kill more than a million animals with our cars in the U.S. alone every single day, which is pretty hard to fathom. And, you know, obviously a lot of those creatures are relatively common ones like white-tailed deer and raccoons and gray squirrels. But, you know, a lot of them are rare species as well, like ocelots and Florida panthers and tiger salamanders, you know, creatures that are existentially threatened by roadkill. So I think that's, you know, the most conspicuous, obvious connection, right, is that roads are just directly killing animals and reducing wildlife populations. But that's really the tip of the iceberg in a lot of ways. You know, we've got road noise pollution that's, you know, seeping into the environment and chasing songbirds and other creatures away from, you know, important habitats. We've got road salt that's, you know, running off our highways after we apply it as a de-icer and you know, turning rivers and lakes brackish. You know, we've got tire particles bleeding into the environment and killing salmon. So there are just so many different ways in which, you know, roads impact nature. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, it really is. And now animals generally have devised strategies to protect themselves from predators. But are any of those strategies effective against cars and roadways?
Not really, unfortunately. I mean, I think that's, you know, one of the really tragic things about cars and roadkill is that, you know, they sort of hijack evolution, right? You think about, you know, the defense strategies of some of our, you know, most common beloved creatures, you know, turtles who withdraw into their shells, or skunks that spray, or porcupines, you know, that bristle their quills, right? These are all kind of stand your ground strategies, and they work really well against, you know, coyotes and cougars and hawks and natural predators. But, you know, when your predator is, you know, a Ford F-150 barreling down the highway at 70 miles an hour, right, the worst possible thing you can do is kind of hunker down and stand to your ground. So I just find that, you know, incredibly sad to think about how, you know, a roadkill just takes millions of years of evolution and renders it, you know, not only moot, but actually maladaptive.
Right, right. You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here with Ben Goldfarb, author, environmental journalist. And we're talking about roadkill. So now, roadkill's been around a long time, you say in your book, even back when people rode in wagons. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Henry David Thoreau observes, you know, turtles getting stuck in the wagon ruts and getting crushed by carriages, right? So, you know, roadkill, as you say, is something that actually predates the automobile. But, you know, of course, once cars start proliferating in the early 20th century, you know, roadkill goes from being this very rare phenomenon to, you know, an incredibly common problem that, you know, lots of biologists observe starting in the 1920s. really begin to, you know, wring their hands about. So, you know, this book that I wrote is about road ecology, right? This field of science that looks at how roads shape nature. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, those first road ecologists popped up in the 1920s. They're counting, you know, dead ground squirrels and woodpeckers and garter snakes and starting to wring their hands about, the enormous toll that Model Ts and Packards and other early cars are having on biological life. So, you know, this field of science really goes back a century or more.
Wow. And a lot of it, a lot of roadkill apparently happens because animals are migrating. So how have those migrations been affected by roads?
Yeah, you know, very, very dramatically. I mean, you're exactly right that animals have to move around the landscape, right? As we've been talking about, you know, they have to find mates and food and water and, you know, all of the things that we need too. And, you know, in many cases, you know, those movements take them across roads, right? I mean, I often think about amphibians, all of those frogs and toads and salamanders, you know, that have to migrate from their kind of upland forest habitats down to their breeding ponds in the spring. You know, they're moving around on these warm, wet spring nights, you know, in just enormous numbers in some places. And the problem is that, you know, we tend to build our roads in low-lying areas, which is the same places that water collects and that amphibians breed. So there's this kind of inherent tension, I think, between where we build roads and where animals migrate, right? We're both, you know, using these valley bottoms and stream corridors, and that's why, you know, in some places, hundreds or even thousands of amphibians, you know, can be crushed in a single breeding season, and populations can really disappear.
As you use the term road ecology and road ecologists, so they began to study the effects of roads on the environment and on migrations, and they did come up with some solutions. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, you know, so I think that the most effective solution that we have, you know, in our toolbox are wildlife crossings, right? These overpasses, underpasses, tunnels, you know, they come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes, but basically, you know, structures that allow animals to cross roads safely. And, you know, these wildlife crossings sort of first pop up really in the 1950s in Europe. You know, France built some of the first for deer across country lanes, you know, then other countries like Germany and Switzerland and, you know, and Austria followed. And, you know, by the 1970s, you know, these things are starting to pop up in the United States as well, you know, especially in the American West, where big populations of mule deer and elk and antelope, you know, these wide ranging ungulates, you know, hoofed mammals are moving across landscapes in places like Wyoming and Utah and Colorado. And, you know, they're crossing highways in really big numbers and they're getting hit in really big numbers. And so all of these Western states start to say, you know, hey, we have these kind of hot spots of roadkill, you know, places where dozens or even hundreds of animals are being killed, you know, every migration season. You know, these might be really good places for some of these wildlife crossings, you know, these underpasses and overpasses that let animals safely move over the highway. And so, yeah, it's really in the, you know, the 70s and 80s that you start to see these structures popping up in the United States, you know, again, mostly for deer and elk, these, you know, these big migratory game animals.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here today with Ben Goldfarb, author and environmental journalist. His book is Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And we were just talking about wildlife crossings. And you have some stories in the book of places where they've worked really well. Can you give us some of those stories?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think one of the really important things to know about wildlife crossings, right, is that, you know, yes, they work really well for the animals, but they also work really well for humans. And, you know, the reason for that is that, look, nobody wants to hit a deer or an elk or another big animal with their car, right? Those are really, you know, dangerous, expensive events. You know, between 200 and 400 drivers get killed in deer crashes every year. You know, the average deer crash costs society more than $9,000 now in vehicle repairs and hospital bills and insurance costs and tow trucks and so on, right? So these are, again, these really perilous, extensive incidents when you hit a large animal. And so, if you can build a wildlife crossing with, fences on either side that keep the animals off the highway and kind of funnel the animals to the crossings, you can prevent a lot of these terrible crashes and thus, save the public a lot of money. So, I think that early on in the history of wildlife crossings, transportation departments said, it's going to cost a few million dollars to, build one of these bridges. Is it really worth it just to help, a few antelope cross the highway? And the answer is yes, it absolutely is, because it just, prevents so many of these expensive crashes that, these wildlife crossings actually pay for themselves very, very quickly. So, one of the places that I visited working on this book was Pinedale, Wyoming, where there's this big migration of both mule deer and pronghorn, the antelope, that move across Highway 191. And in sort of the early to mid 2000s, the Wyoming Department of Transportation built, two overpasses and a bunch of underpasses right along this migration route. And again, people kind of were skeptical at first. Are animals really going to use these things? Is it really worth spending, $10 to $15 million on building them? And, there the answer was absolutely. Roadkill rates fell by, 80 to 90%, as they typically do when you build these structures. These migrations that had been basically stopped and thwarted by traffic were able to continue safely over and under the highway. So that's, a really good kind of classic example of how both people and wild animals can, really benefit from these sorts of projects.
Wildlife crossings may be one of the few issues in the environmental field that generally has support across the political spectrum. I asked Ben Goldfarb, why is that?
These wildlife crossings are truly nonpartisan, right? Nobody wants to hit an animal, you see incredibly high support rates for these structures, even in, very red places that, might not otherwise be super conservation minded, states like Nevada, the support for wildlife crossings polls at something like 90%. So, we live in this very polarized society where, every environmental initiative seems to be, greeted with outrage by somebody. And yet, wildlife crossings are truly nonpartisan in a way that, very few other things are. I can't really think of another, environmental solution that's supported equally by the hunting lobby and the Humane Society, right? So then I think another possible answer is that, the highway is, it's this very easy, conspicuous scapegoat in some ways, right? Where we can say, hey, look at all of these dead deer. This is the problem. This is why, mule deer populations around the American West are collapsing. We're just killing so many of them, by the side of the highway. You can see the carcasses, right? And, what you don't necessarily see are, all of the oil and gas drilling operations, out in Bureau of Land Management land in the middle of nowhere that are also disrupting migrations and reducing population, or, all of the suburban sprawl that's kind of, filling in a lot of these valleys and cutting off migration routes, right? So the oil industry and developers and ranchers, these are very powerful political lobbies in some ways. And in some ways, I think it's easier to just work on the road issue, which is, certainly a real problem, and say, we're going to build a bunch of these wildlife crossings and maybe that'll kind of deflect attention from, other industrial activities that might be impacting wildlife.
You're listening to Mothering Earth. I'm Salwa Khan, here with Ben Goldfarb, author and environmental journalist. And then one animal that many of us encounter on roads is the white-tailed deer. I know we do here where I am in Texas. We have a lot of them in our neighborhood. We have whole herds. Why are they so prevalent?
In some ways, we've created amazing deer habitat, right? In part with our highways. You think about the highways, you know, especially in the middle of the 20th century, you know, these new interstate highways being built in the, you know, 50s, 60s and 70s, basically funneling people out of cities and into suburbs, you know, helping to create these new suburbs. And, you know, suburbs are great deer habitat, right? You know, deer like edges, you know, sort of the places where fields and forests meet, and suburbs just have lots of edges. And, you know, there's research showing that, you know, in many suburbs, you know, in places like Virginia or Texas, as you said, or, you know, or New York, the suburban New York where I grew up, you know, deer populations are actually much, much higher than they were at the time of European arrival, because, you know, these suburbs have just created such good habitat, and they're, you know, they're all eating our ornamental landscaping and our gardens and so on, right? And so that's, you know, one of the, again, another kind of tragic irony or tension of highways, is that they created the conditions for this white-tailed deer explosion. And now, of course, so many deer get hit on highways. You know, it's an immense source of animal suffering. It's also, as you know, as we've been talking about, you know, a real danger to drivers as well. So, you know, highways are both sort of encouraging deer population growth and also making life really dangerous for both the deer and the drivers.
Right. And it's sad to say, but many people also die on our roadways every day, every year. Does road ecology have any solution for people?
Look, I think that the same lesson applies in both situations, which is that, you know, speed is incredibly dangerous, right? You know, we know that, you know, that the most important thing we can do to prevent pedestrian accidents is, you know, is really traffic calming measures, you know, figuring out ways to get people to drive more slowly, you know, whether that means narrower lanes or I mean, signage is not super helpful, but, you know, better enforcement in some cases. And, you know, I think the same is true in a road ecology context. You know, we know that, you know, once you're going more than 45 miles an hour or so, especially at night, you know, both your ability to brake for wildlife and the animal's ability to avoid your car is, you know, is dramatically reduced. And so, you know, I think that at the end of the day, you know, speed is the most dangerous aspect of our roads and cars, and you know, anything we can do to limit speed ends up being, you know, really important for both for human pedestrians and for wild animals.
And then the big question: how does climate change, some of which is driven by cars, affect road ecology?
Yeah, it's another great and complicated question. I mean, as you say, certainly, right. Cars are a huge contributor to climate change. You know, something like a quarter of American carbon emissions are from the transportation sector. So, you know, if we can get people out of cars, obviously that's good for the climate. You know, I think the other side of that coin, right, is what does climate change, as you said, mean for road ecology? And I think that one of the challenges is that, you know, animals are moving around already, and, you know, and climate change is going to make them move around more, right? So you could imagine a situation in which you built a wildlife overpass for, you know, a migrating herd of elk, you know, in Wyoming or Montana, and then, you know, 10 years from now, you know, that herd of elk has moved north or, you know, upslope because of climate change, and now, you know, your wildlife overpass isn't as effective. So, you know, one of the cool technologies that's being explored by researchers right now are basically these kind of modular wildlife overpasses that can actually be disassembled and reassembled. So you could build one today for the herd of elk, and then 10 years from now, when the elk have moved, you know, 20 miles north, you can actually pick that wildlife crossing up and reassemble it in a new location so that it's still functional for the animals. I think that's a really exciting line of research that, you know, some scientists are working on now.
And then you write about the Yellowstone to Yukon Conservation Initiative, which you describe as a very ambitious attempt to protect wildlife. What is that project and what is it proposed to do?
Yeah, you know, in some ways it's that Yellowstone to Yukon project, or Y2Y as it's known, that really got me excited about this topic. You know, basically the idea is to create a sort of a continuous stretch of connected habitat, you know, that goes all the way from the greater Yellowstone ecosystem in Wyoming and Montana, all the way up into the Yukon Territory in northern Canada. You know, again, the idea being that there are all of these wide-ranging animals who live in the northern Rockies. You know, you've got grizzly bears and wolves and wolverines and caribou. You know, these are big, mobile creatures that have to move through really large, connected and protected landscapes. You know, Y2Y has done a lot of work on these wildlife crossings over the years, both, you know, researching them and advocating for them and, you know, sort of changing the policy around, you know, when and where they can be implemented. You know, basically the idea being that, right, we need to connect and reconnect these landscapes, you know, if all of these big wide-ranging creatures are going to survive. And so that's a lot of what Y2Y has successfully worked on, as well as, you know, increasing social tolerance in the region and, you know, creating programs that help farmers and ranchers live with wild animals and coexist with them. So, you know, there's this infrastructural piece where you're, you know, helping animals cross highways, but there's also this social piece where you're helping them cross farmlands and ranch lands and other private lands, you know, without getting shot by humans. And, you know, that's in some ways, I think that's more complicated than the infrastructure.
You said you've been working on this book for quite a while. So over the time that you've been working on it, has how you think about roads changed in any way?
Yeah, you know, it certainly has. I mean, I think I'm much more cognizant of their impacts. One of the impacts that I've become really much more aware of is noise pollution. You know, I think, look, we're so awash in noise pollution that we basically don't notice it, right? We're just surrounded by cars all the time. But you know, when you read the road noise pollution literature, the peer reviewed literature, you know, as I did working on this book, you know, you realize that road noise is elevating our heart rates and our blood pressures and our risk of stroke and cardiac disease and diabetes. You know, road noise is literally killing us. You know, it's taking years off of our lives. There's one amazing study that basically compared the quietest neighborhoods in Paris with the noisiest neighborhoods. And basically what they found was that people in the quieter neighborhoods lived 3 years longer than people in the noisy neighborhoods. So, you know, so again, I mean, road noise is, it's just literally killing us. And, you know, when I started working on this book, my wife and I were living in Spokane, Washington, you know, very close to I-90. We were on this kind of busy arterial road. We were just surrounded by road noise and we didn't really notice it. And then, you know, I read this all of this research and said, oh, you know, holy cow, this is really, yeah, it's killing us. And so, you know, when we ended up moving to Colorado a couple of years ago, you know, we really prioritized finding a very quiet street without all of this road noise pollution. And you know, I think we're a lot happier and healthier as a result.
That's a lot to think about. This has been Mothering Earth on Road Ecology. Thanks so much to our guest, author and environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb. And thanks so much to you for listening. Our website is mothering-earth.com. Mothering Earth is also on Instagram at mothering_earth. This is Salwa Khan signing off for Mothering Earth, your source for sustainable living news. The views and opinions expressed on Mothering Earth do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of this station.